Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. The Asian financial crisis of the late 1990s prompted Malaysia to implement a series of reforms aimed at fortifying its financial institutions. Now, one of the most prominent measures during the time was the consolidation of the banking sector, leading to a reduction in the number of domestic commercial banks from 22 to just 10 by the year 2002. Now, while the goal was to create stability and strength within the financial industry, it introduced a new set of challenges, particularly for the country's SMEs. Now, the pivotal question that arises now is that after more than two decades, how has the banking consolidation impacted the ability of SMEs in Malaysia to secure capital? One man who's been pondering on this question is Professor Wu Wing Tai. He's Vice President for Asia at the United Nations Sustainable Development Solutions Network. He heads the Asia headquarters of SDSN, hosted by the Geoffrey Chia Foundation at Sunway University, where he is a research professor. Professor Wu, thank you for joining me on the show today. I want to begin our conversation today by, this phrase that we've heard repeated many times, that SMEs are the backbone of the Malaysian economy. 97% of all businesses in Malaysia are SMEs or micro SMEs. Now, in a recent opinion piece that you wrote, you argued that Malaysia hasn't fully tapped into the potential of SMEs, that in fact, SMEs aren't faring as well as they should. Can we begin our conversation there with how you think SMEs are faring now in this current landscape?
The SMEs are not modernizing their technology. And their lack of modernization means that workers' productivity remains low. And so the way that the SMEs are seeking to increase their profits is to look for even cheaper labor by asking the government to let in large amount of low-skilled foreign labor. This, of course, will have very terrible effects on low-skilled domestic labor, because then their wages would never go up. What is really wrong is not labor shortage. What is wrong is that even if the SMEs have the ambition to improve the productivity of the workers by modernizing technology, they would have a lot of trouble trying to get the funds to do so. Right now, they even face tremendous difficulties in getting sufficient working capital to order to buy intermediate inputs to fulfill the orders that they have on hand. This has not always been the situation. The big difficulties of getting working capital, when the difficulties went up tremendously after 2002, because you had earlier said that the number of banks went from 22 to 10. What is even more astounding is that the number of finance companies went from 45 to 10. So all of the finance companies that disappeared were the small and medium finance companies, just like the banks that disappeared were small and medium banks. One thing we know from all over the world is that the chief source of working capital for small and medium enterprises and the source of investment capital are from the small and medium banks and from small and medium finance companies. So when they cause this small and medium financial institutions to disappear, that was a real crunch in the working capital situation of the small and medium banks, which is why within 3 years, the government founded the SME Bank to try to solve the problem. And of the fact is that the problem the difficulties have not gone down. You could see it by going past any main street in Kuala Lumpur, and you will see on the lamppost signs of asking that, do you need a loan? Call a loan number one at this number. Basically, there's a great shortage of working capital shortage. And so what we have is we have an explosion of our loans in response to this capital shortage. They are doing something very risky because this is an illegal activity. But yet, because of the shortage, they're able to collect a high interest for it.
Okay. Professor Wu, if I may just interject here, I want to get you to unpack and elaborate some of the things that you've just laid out for us. First things first, you said that small and medium banks and small and medium finance companies have traditionally been the primary sources of working capital and capital investment for SMEs. Why hasn't, post-consolidation, the anchor banks taken on that role? What is that obstacle? What are the barriers?
Well, one thing is that it is, when you lend $1 million to a big corporation, the cost of that paperwork is the same as making a $100,000 loan to a small company, because the forms you fill in and all of the time that you spend is roughly the same. So if you make $1 million worth of small loans of $100,000 each, you end up with a pile of paperwork that you could avoid if you could just make one big loan and be done with it. So that is the incentive that exists, which is that you would rather make big loans than small loans. Then there's the question of capability. If you look at the managers of the big banks, of the branches that are outside of Kuala Lumpur, the branches outside of the main towns, these are people who were promoted from a branch office in Kuala Lumpur or Penang or Ipoh to one of these outlying towns. So these people really do not know the characteristics of the local SME community. Whereas a local small and medium bank, the owner operator would have gone to school with all of the local entrepreneurs, and he knows the family background, what's the financial resources of the extended family of that person, and how tight is that particular extended family. This kind of knowledge is very localized, and it's hard for someone standing from the outside to learn it very quickly. So they make, even when they make loans to the small and medium enterprises, they are unable to select the, should we say, the one that are least risky of the pile. And so they have trouble making good loans. And because they have trouble making good loans to small enterprises, they want to avoid that as well. So first, that is the cost of making small loan is the same as the cost of making one big loan. And second, their screening mechanism is not as good as the screening mechanism of the local owner operator of the small and medium bank. So this is the reason why the SMEs have had trouble getting working capital.
Okay, but what about SME Bank? You raised it earlier, since its inception in 2005. You claimed it failed. In fact, if I may quote your opinion piece, you wrote, quote, "The unsurprising failure of this government-owned SME bank induced the flowering of illegal Ahlong financiers." Can we talk a little bit about what you meant when you wrote the unsurprising failure of SME Bank? What were its shortcomings, in your opinion?
Well, there are two. They did, first of all, the size of the SME bank was definitely smaller. The scale, the amount of capital that it had was much lower than the amount of capital that the group of 1997 small and medium banks had. In other words, if you add up the capital stock, the capital of and reserves of the small and medium banks in 1998, as a percent of GDP, it'll be much higher than what the SME bank capital is. That's number one. They don't have the size. And number two, they have not been able to solve the problem of being able to accurately assess the credit worthiness of the entrepreneurs. Largely because, again, the SME bank, the managers are sent from central office. They are parachuted into the local community, and that they are expected to then be able to figure out the risk characteristics of each of the entrepreneur. That is a very difficult job. That is number one. And number two, you must understand that what is it about a government, what is it that a government bank can do better than a private bank? Basically, if we ask ourselves, is there a greater incentive to perform well compared with a private bank? I would say any banks that run according to civil service regulations is going to be much more conservative, because if one of the loan goes bad, you can forget about being promoted to the next level. This is quite common. Here it is interesting to talk about the experience of Taiwan. Taiwan had a lot of state-owned banks, but they also had a lot of illegal finance corporations that are allowed to operate in the open. The interest rates of all of these illegal small and medium banks are reported in the newspaper every day. And basically the government doesn't go close them down. And since they didn't face any risk, they operated pretty much like what a private bank could do, but they operate without deposit insurance. So the reason why Taiwan had such a thriving small and medium enterprise sector is because they effectively allowed the existence of small and medium banks to operate to exist without the government clamping down on them. And since the government does not clamp down on them, the risk is lower of being hauled to the court, so they don't need to charge such high interest rates. So this is a good example of when the financial sector is allowed to operate on its own, it's able to find a niche that serves the local community. What is exceedingly... go ahead, Melissa.
Sorry. If I may just jump in here, I do want to explore with you what would be the obstacles in reintroducing some of these smaller and medium banks or finance companies. But first of all, I want to ask you, the government has repeatedly stated its commitment to helping SMEs through providing multiple avenues for grants and incentives and subsidies. Can I ask you why that hasn't been enough to boost the SMEs in Malaysia?
Largely because the government doesn't have enough money to hand out to enable large-scale modernization by the SMEs. The government, since the government doesn't have the fiscal resources to hand out, the government has to rely on the mobilization of private savings to do it. And what the government could do, how do we get the small and medium banks into existence? One way is clearly to start selling licenses for small and medium banks. Another way is the government owns at least 5 of the large big banks. Pick any one of them. Split that particular bank into 3 small and medium banks. Sell it. The government first would get the revenue from selling these large banks after breaking it up into 3 small and medium banks. And the first question is, would these banks be run worse than before? I would like to say there are enough ambitious bankers who will be happy to buy one of these 3 and take it on. So competition will be increased, and the number of small and medium banks catering to small and medium enterprises would go up. And more importantly, the government now has got the revenue to undertake important investments that the country needs. For example, the transition to green energy here in Malaysia. Okay. We have no choice but to transform our energy sector into green energy, largely because the rest of the world is going to punish us if we don't do it.
Right.
So what you're proposing is quite a radical change in the current ecosystem infrastructure of the financial sector. The consolidation was done initially in response to an Asian financial crisis damaged balance sheet of banks. What consequences or what do you think might happen, or risks, might there be risks to the current financial infrastructure if banks are broken up, bigger banks are broken up to be smaller and medium banks?
The financial system will be safer because these are now smaller banks. A failure by any one of them would not bring the whole system crashing down. Right now, we have got 10 big banks. They are all too big to fail. And when the bankers misbehave, they are too big to be jailed. Basically, we now have a financial sector that is guaranteed to be bailed out by the government, even if they are thoroughly embezzled by the managers, because we can't afford any one of them to fail, because they will bring the whole system crashing down. Why should we have such time bombs? We want to have little firecrackers so that if any one of them explode, it will not bring down the financial system. In fact, having big banks is a more dangerous system than a whole collection of small banks. And the truth is, when they want to restructure the balance sheets of the different banks, consolidating them under the big banks is one way. Another way is the government could have directly restructured these small and medium banks and then reorganize them. And basically, it's just like the savings and loan crisis in the United States in the 1980s, where over 2,000 small and medium banks failed in the US. But yet, there was no 2008 financial crisis because all of them were small banks. The government just took them over, kick out the owners, recapitalize the banks, in other words, sell the banks to new owners, and then the bank opens up and operate. That's what the bankruptcy system is set up to handle. And we could have done exactly that. And I think that the consolidation into 10 banks had involved elements of possibly the desire to strengthen the hand of the government in the control of the banking sector. And I think that was an unnecessary move. The country is already, our major industries are dominated by GLCs. And then the next thing they did was to turn the financial sector to be dominated by GLBs, government-linked banks. That, I think, rendered us more socialist than most communist countries, than most social democrat countries in Western Europe. State ownership much bigger in Malaysia than in Sweden, right, Norway, or Denmark.
Having said that, why would what would incentivize the government then to relinquish some of that long-held embedded control in the financial sector?
Two reasons. One is it will be, they will truly make the SMEs the drivers of the new industrial master plan that was unleashed. The new industrial master plan is meant to kick the country into catching up to the technological level is the G7. We got to set, know what our goal is. Our goal is to have the living standard of the United States, Japan, and Germany. That's the goal. And in order to achieve that goal, we need to reach technological parity. That's why we have the new industrial master plan. To reach technological parity, our enterprises will have to upgrade themselves technologically. And since 95% of our enterprises are SMEs, we definitely want a lot of them to upgrade themselves. We cannot just depend on that 5% of enterprises to upgrade themselves to the level of technology in the G7 and the other 95 lagging behind. As a matter of math, that just won't work. So we got to be able to allow our SMEs to be able to get the funds to modernize. We now have a very good situation because of the US-China tensions. The G7 are cutting the imports they are bringing in from China. And that's why we got a rush of FDI into Penang and Johor in the last 3 years, largely because they want to produce here and export to the G7 markets. The truth is, FDI could pick up, could start coming here to produce those exports. But how about local firms growing up and modernizing and start exporting as well. In other words, we got a very good confluence of the demand is there. Now what we want is them to modernize. So the government has to announce very clearly that the program of low-skill foreign labor will be phased out. We cannot have a cutoff because there is a shock, a needless shock to the existing SMEs. If you announce a phase-out, and given the fact that the demand of the G7 markets have gone up, the SMEs have the incentive to modernize. SMEs, being small businessmen, tends to be quite conservative. And unless they see that the return is so obviously worth it, only then would they go take the loan. So here we have this existing situation of the intrinsic conservatism of small businesses because they cannot afford to take risk. And then you make it harder for them to get funds when they decide to take the risk. That is unneeded. And so if the government could set up schemes to encourage the new small medium enterprise banks to lend to SMEs, you could have loan insurance schemes, or you could give some degrees of subsidy. And where would the government get the money from it? The government can get it by selling off some of these big banks that it has and some of the big GLCs that we have. Right. And it's just like the following. Just like the government needs to do something about fuel subsidy, right? Largely because here we are trying to reduce CO2 emission, but we are also subsidizing the use of gas.
Right.
But then we subsidize the use of gas because it's a good, it's a product that everybody uses. The poor use it too. So why don't, if we were to consider removing that particular subsidy, we have to compensate the poor in another way. And right. How can we compensate the poor? We can give them a one-time subsidy to buy an electric motorbike away from the gas motorbike that they had.
Understood.
The poor rides motorbikes.
So, Professor Wu, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our program, and I want to thank you for sharing your insights and giving us some food for thought today. Thank you for being on the show. That was Professor Wu Wing Thai wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.